Welcome to today's reading of Uncommon Wonders. I'm Kyla Thomas for the Virginia Voice. Our first article, One Man's Fight to Preserve Pakistan's Perfect Cooking Pot. The Gorkhan is a marvel of heat retention that's at risk of disappearing, by Junacy Hawkins of Atlas Obscura. In 2000, a Japanese tourist walked into Syed Israr Hussain's guest house in Minipin, Pakistan. While most visitors come to the village nestled in the Nagar Valley below Rekapashi Mountain in the Krikoram Range to hike or to summit the peak, this tourist had a different agenda. The tourist asked, no, he demanded, remembers Hussain, to be served a very specific meal. He had fond memories of a delicious chicken stew he had eaten when he visited the village 30 years earlier. The stew, he noted, had been cooked to perfection in a gorkhan, a lidded pot carved from a local stone. Hussain was taken by surprise by the request. Although he had memories of his grandmother cooking meat and turnips in a gorkhan during winters when he was a small child, it had been a long time since he had seen one being used, long enough that he had almost entirely forgotten about them. Undaunted and curious, Hussain began looking for gorkhan pots within Minipin. He found a local who had long since used one and let him try it. Hussain brought the gorkhan to the guest house, soaked it in water to restore it and clean it of decades-old dust, and made chicken stew for the guest. The stew was exactly what the tourist remembered. Hussain says this episode led him to bring back this old tradition by introducing the cooking method in his restaurant. The gorkhan is a bit of a marvel. Once removed from a heat source, it will keep the stew inside boiling for over half an hour, depending on the size of the pot, and warm for much longer. Traditionally, the gorkhan was carved from stone, known in the local language as balosh, though other types were also used. Before modern iron tools, artisans used the hard horns of the local Himalayan ibex to carve the stone into pots. This process took 2 to 3 years for one single gorkhan, making them prized possessions passed down from generation to generation. But over the past several decades, the treasured vessel has disappeared. A victim of the changing culinary landscape in Gilgit-Baltistan, the region where Minipin is located. The completion of the Karakoram Highway in 1978 ushered in a cooking revolution in the area, and once common foodways were replaced with new ones. For one, pressure cookers arrived, bringing with them an ease and speed of cooking that the gorkhan couldn't match. The gorkhan, which means sizzling pot, had been a staple of the kitchen in this area for hundreds of years, if not more. No one knows its exact origin. But with the arrival of the pressure cooker, steel, and other modern cooking methods to this once isolated place, gorkhan cooking began to fade away. And it wasn't just the cooking methods that changed. What locals cooked changed, too. Whereas food once revolved around simple local ingredients like apricots and their oil, walnut oil, and homemade butter known as desi ghee, today you can find a variety of foods that are more heavily spiced than that migrated from elsewhere in Pakistan. Ashotang, Hussain's guest house, has become a hub for restoring some of these lost traditions. For the past years, Hussain has collected old pots from Minipin and the surrounding villages in the Nagar Valley and cooked in them for his guests. Today, he has a large collection of gorkhans, some almost 200 years old. The pot, Hussain explains, has become his trademark. The food his restaurant cooks in the gorkhans is very traditional. No masalas, because in the old times there were no masalas here. Only simple things, he says. But simple does not mean bland. The food cooked in these pots, typically chicken or mutton stew with onions, tomatoes, and some spices, has a distinctive taste that cannot be achieved by other cooking methods, according to locals. The slow cooking renders the meat so tender you don't need a knife, and the gorkhan itself imparts the sort of earthy flavor that stainless steel can only dream about. The spices are mild and let the fresh flavors of the Hussain's free-range animals and organic ingredients shine, and outsiders agree. Hussain's gorkhan food attracts tourists, both local and foreign, and Ashotang has become a culinary destination. It's our culture, you know, and it is tasty, Hussain says. Back in the big cities in Pakistan, they have modern pots, but Minipin, they have the gorkhan. They like to eat pizza, he says, of city dwellers with westernized diets, but this is not our culture. Others in Gilgit-Baltistan has been taking notice of Hussain's work. When he began to experience success with gorkhan-made meals by attracting attention and guests to his restaurant, other guest houses and restaurants started offering them too. Some of these places are located in the same village as Hussein, but others are in different parts of Gilgit-Baltistan. Some notable visitors to Ashtotang seeking Gorkhan food, according to Hussein, have included the Prime Minister of Pakistan and the United States Ambassador. The allure of the Gorkhan draws people into a region that is difficult to access, bringing with them much-needed tourist money and the promise of a new audience for old traditions. Some tourists even want to buy a Gorkhan and take it home, and to accommodate that demand, a few local shops now sell Gorkhans, both old and new. Unfortunately, buying new Gorkhans may soon become impossible. With lower demand for the pots in the post-Krakoram highway age, combined with the other cultural changes, fewer artisans are learning the craft of producing the vessels. Hussein, who has become a respected authority on Gorkhans, says that, to his knowledge, there are only two artisans still carving Gorkhans in all of Gilgit-Baltistan. But even if only old Gorkhans remain, Hussein's quest revived a tradition on the brink of extinction, and in the process brought attention to Gilgit-Baltistan's culture and food ways. Local families, too, have taken up Gorkhan cooking once more, keeping the tradition alive. Hussein, for one, is grateful for what the Gorkhan has done for the region and himself. I'm thankful to this pot. Scientists accidentally discovered strange creatures under half a mile of ice. Researchers drilled through an Antarctic ice shelf to sample sediment, but they found animals that weren't supposed to be there. By Matt Simon of Atlas Obscura. This story was originally published in Wired and appears here as part of the Climate Desk collaboration. Biovac in the middle of the Fleschner-Rhône ice shelf, a five-hour flight from the nearest Antarctic station. Nothing comes easy. Even though it was the southern summer, geologist James Smith of the British Antarctic Survey endured nearly 3 months of freezing temperatures, sleeping in a tent and eating dehydrated food. The science itself was a hassle. To study the history of the floating shelf, he needed seafloor sediment, which was locked under half a mile of ice. To get to it, Smith and his colleagues had to melt 20 tons of snow to create 20,000 liters of hot water, which they then pumped through a pipe lower down a borehole. It took them 20 hours to melt through the ice, inch by inch, finally piercing through the shelf. Next, they lowered an instrument to collect the sediment along with a GoPro camera. But the collector came back empty. They tried once more, still empty. Again, nothing comes easy here. Each round trip of the instrument took an hour. Later that night, in his tent, Smith watched the footage and recognized a rather glaring problem. The video shows a descent through 3,000 feet of blue-green ice, which suddenly terminates, opening up into dark seawater. The camera coasts another 1,600 feet until the seafloor finally comes into view. Mostly light-colored sediment, which Smith was after, but also something dark. That dark thing turned out to be a rock, which the camera hits with a thud, tumbling face down into the sediment. The camera quickly rights itself and scans the rock, revealing something the geologists hadn't been after at all. In fact, it was something highly improbable. Life. It's like bloody hell, Smith says. It's just one big boulder in the middle of a relatively flat seafloor. It's not as if the seafloor is littered with these things. Just his luck to drill in the only wrong place. Wrong place for collecting seafloor muck, but the absolute right place for a once-in-a-million shot at finding life in an environment that scientists didn't reckon could support much of it. Smith is no biologist, but his colleague, Hugh Griffiths of the British Antarctic Survey, is. When Griffiths watched the footage back in the UK, he noticed a kind of film on the rock, likely a layer of bacteria known as microbial mat. An alien-like sponge and other stalked animals dangled from the rock, while stouter, cylindrical sponges hugged the surface. The rock was also lined with wispy filaments, perhaps a component of the bacterial mats or perhaps a peculiar animal known as a hydroid. The rock Smith had accidentally discovered is 160 miles from daylight, that is, the nearest edge of the shelf where ice ends and the open ocean begins. It's hundreds of miles from the nearest location that might be a source of food, a spot that would have enough sunlight to fuel an ecosystem and be in the right position relative to the rock for known currents to supply these creatures with sustenance. Not to tell life its business, but it's got no right being here. It's not the most exciting-looking rock if you don't know where it is, says Griffiths, lead author of a new study published in the journal Frontiers in Marine Science. Since you now do know, then it means your jaw may be somewhere near the floor right about now. We can say for certain that these animals are living in total darkness, which is fine. Plenty of deep-sea critters do the same. But animals that live sessile, read stuck in place, existences on the deep seafloor must rely on a fairly steady supply of food in the form of marine snow. Every living thing swimming in the water column above must one day die, and when they do, they sink to the depths. As the corpses descend and decompose, other creatures pick at them, fling off particles, tiny morsels that accumulate even on the deepest of seafloors. When a whale dies and sinks, by the way, it's epically known as a whale fall. This works in most parts around Antarctica, where the waters are incredibly productive. Tiny critters known as plankton feed all kinds of fish, which feed large marine mammals like seals. All this activity produces detritus and dead animals that one day become marine snow. But the Antarctic critters on this particular rock don't live under a bustling water column. They live under half a mile of solid ice, and they can't roam away from their rock in search of food. The worst thing in a place where there's not much food, and it's very sporadic, is to be something that's glued to the spot, says Griffiths. So how on earth could they be getting sustenance? The researchers think that it's likely that the drift of this marine snow has been flipped on its side so that the food source is moving horizontally instead of vertically. Looking at charts of currents near the drill site, the researchers determined that there are productive regions between 390 and 930 miles away. It may not be much, but it's possible that enough organic material is riding these currents hundreds of miles to feed these creatures. That's an extraordinary distance, given that in the deepest part of the ocean, the Challenger Deep near Guam, marine snow produced at the surface has to fall 7 miles down to reach the seafloor. To reach the animals on this Antarctic rock, food would have to travel as much as 133 times that distance, and it would have to do so by floating sideways. Given what the scientists know about currents around Antarctica, this isn't particularly far-fetched, says Rich Moai, curator of invertebrate zoology and geology at the California Academy of Sciences, who has studied Antarctic sea life but wasn't involved in this new work. As seawater cools in this region, it grows more dense. It sinks to the sea bottom and pushes water outward, radiating outward from the Antarctic, says Moai. And these currents are actually the germ of many, if almost all of it, the current systems on the planet. As the water pushes outward, something has to fill the void. There's going to be some inflow to replace that, Moai adds. And that inflow, even over hundreds of kilometers, is going to carry organic matter. For our life forms stuck on that boulder, this would bring food. The currents could also bring new animals to add to the population on the rock. But because the researchers couldn't collect specimens, they can't yet say what exactly these sponges and other critters could be eating. Some sponges filter organic detritus from the water, whereas others are carnivorous, feasting on tiny animals. That would be sort of your headline of the year, says Christopher Ma, a marine biologist at the Smithsonian who wasn't involved in the research. Killer sponges living in the dark, cold recesses of Antarctica where no life can survive. And Griffiths and his team also can't yet say if mobile creatures, like fish and crustaceans, also live around the rock. The camera didn't glimpse any, so it's not clear if the sessile animal face some kind of predation. Are they all eating the same food source? Asked Griffiths. Or some of them kind of getting nutrients from each other? Or are there more mobile animals around somehow providing food for this community? There are questions only other expeditions can answer. It does appear that sedimentation around the rock isn't very heavy, meaning the animals aren't in danger of being buried. It's kind of a Goldilocks-type thing going on, says Griffiths, of the rock's apparently fortuitous location, where it's got just enough food coming in, and it's got nothing that wants to eat them, as far as we can tell, and it's not getting buried by too much sediment. In the sediment surrounding the rock, the researchers also noticed ripples that are typically formed by currents, thus bolstering the theory that the food is being carried here from afar. It's also not clear how these stationary animals got there in the first place. Was it something very local, where they kind of hopped from local boulder to local boulder? Asked Griffiths. Alternatively, perhaps their parents lived on a rock hundreds of miles away, where the ice shelf ends and more typical marine ecosystems begin, and release their sperm and eggs to travel in the currents. Because Griffiths and his colleagues don't have specimens, they also can't say how old these animals are. Antarctic sponges have been known to live for thousands of years, so it's possible that this is a truly ancient ecosystem. Perhaps the rock was seeded with life long ago, but currents have also refreshed it with additional life over the millennia. The researchers also can't say whether this rock is an aberration or if such ecosystems are actually common under the ice. Maybe the geologists didn't get extremely lucky when they dropped their camera onto the lock. Maybe these animal communities are a regular feature of the seafloor beneath Antarctica's ice shelves. There'd certainly be a lot of room for such ecosystems. These floating ice shelves stretch for 560,000 square miles. Yet though previous boreholes, scientists have only explored an area underneath them equal the size of a tennis court. So it may well be that they're out there in numbers and we just haven't found them yet. And we may be running out of time to do so. This rock may be locked away under half a mile of ice, that ice is increasingly imperiled on a warming planet. There is a potential that some of these big ice shelves in the future could collapse, says Griffiths, and we could lose a unique ecosystem. Do you speak chicken? A new study shows most people can tune into how chickens are feeling based on their clucks alone, by Roxanne Horn of Atlas Obscura. A hiss from your cat, a growl from your dog. You don't need four legs to recognize these warnings. Back off, quit it, danger. Most of us can also translate soft purrs or playful yips as contentment or an invitation to play. It turns out humans may be just as good at understanding the language of our feathered friends. A recent study in Royal Society Open Science shows that humans can intuitively pick up on basic chicken emotions, excitement, and discontent by the sound of their clucks alone. Nearly 70% of people could match the cluck with the correct emotion regardless of their previous experience with chickens or lack thereof. This research reminds us of humans' innate connection to other beings and our ability to pick up on universal signs of happiness and distress, says co-author Joerg Henning of Australia's University of Queensland. This is a remarkable result and further strengthens evidence that humans have the ability to perceive the emotional context of vocalizations made by different species, says Henning in a press release. Chickens can communicate with each other in a myriad of ways. They use body language, such as flashing their feathers, but their less expressive faces may lead humans to overlook their complex emotions, says backyard chicken expert Tove Danovich, author of Under the Henfluence, who was not involved in the study. They're not facially expressive because, of course, they have beaks, which I think is one of the problems that chickens have for their PR campaign, for people to take them a little bit more seriously, she says. But they are very expressive in other ways. Primarily, they use their loud, diverse, and unique voices. Chicken owners like Danovich know their chickens' distinct clucks as well, signaling when they're excited or scared, as well as a special scream song celebration reserved for egg laying. Henning and his co-authors wondered if humans were capable of picking up on the basic nuances of chicken well-being from sound alone. The team recruited nearly 200 participants from around the world, including people who had never been around chickens, for an online survey. Individuals listened to 16 randomly ordered hen clucks, including fast clucks and food calls, a distinct tuck-tuck-tucking sound, both of which indicate excitement, and those associated with negative emotions, such as low growly gackles and wavering higher-pitched whine calls. Researchers were surprised to find that familiarity with chickens didn't influence participants' ability to interpret chicken moods based on the animal's vocalizations. They found 69% of all participants could tell if a chicken sounded excited or displeased, regardless of their previous knowledge of chickens. They also found that older participants were more likely to think the chicken sound was a happy one when it was actually upset. The difference in age groups is difficult to explain, but may be owing to reduced hearing ability of older people, says Henning. Danovich isn't surprised that the majority of humans can pick up on basic chicken emotions through sound. Honestly, it makes a lot of sense to me, she says. We think of animals as being so different from humans, but of course, we're just another species. Different species of birds are able to pick up on each other's alarm calls, and other animals, including humans, can pick up on cues for danger or discontent in other species. I think it really behooves animals to be able to pick up on distress calls from the other creatures around us, she says. And just because we think of ourselves as being very separate from the rest of the non-human world, it really doesn't mean that we are. Researchers highlighted that having another metric for indicating chicken well-being could add to the growing case for more humane animal husbandry. Danovich adds that studies like these remind us that chickens are dynamic and individual beings, just like every other species. They're definitely more than bird brain, says Danovich. If you take the time to get to know them, they can be just as complex as our dogs and cats. Attuning to her own backyard flock not only allows Danovich to pick up on individual chickens' excited, mad, frustrated, and celebratory songs, making her a better caretaker, it's made her more aware of her everyday surroundings. I think we sometimes go through life without noticing the world around us, she adds, adding that this wider awareness also benefits her chickens, especially when hawks and other predators are near. I used to really not be aware of those alarm calls that wild birds would make in my yard until I got chickens. Now I, too, am using those signals from other species to help protect my chickens. And now it's just something I'm aware of when I go through the world. Frankly, it makes the world a more exciting and complex place. The surprising roots of ancient Rome's gladiator fights. The quintessential Rome spectacle original, A Way to Honor the Dead, was not Roman in origin, by Nikki Thiessen of Atlas Obscura. The Brutus dynasty was among the most powerful families in early Roman Republic. It was a Brutus, Lucius Janius, who led the revolt against the last king of Rome and helped found the Republic itself in 509 BC. Throughout Roman history, his descendants would hold every important state office and view themselves as true defenders of Rome. In 264 BC, Brutus Para, an important member of this august political family, died. His sons elected to honor him with a tribute called a minues, essentially a public wake that included distribution of meats and wine. But the brothers also wanted the minues to include something more memorable, a fight to the death. The brothers' decision would begin a centuries-long tradition of bloody gladiatorial spectacles in the Eternal City. Today, these brutal battles seem like the quintessential ancient Roman event, but like much of ancient Roman culture, the tradition was actually imported from elsewhere. Roman author Ausonius specified that the gladiatorial match to honor Brutus Para comprised six gladiators fighting with weapons and armor of the Thracians, a people who occupied what is now Bulgaria. There is no record of how the fight went, but it is likely that the six unfortunate slaves purchased by the Brutus brothers hacked away at each other until there was only one left alive. Blood had been spilled and meat and wine had been shared. The soul of Brutus Para could begin its journey to the afterlife, and the plebeians of Rome had got a taste for bloody spectacles. Gladiatorial fights of the sort organized for the funeral of Brutus Para were a type of human sacrifice. Such sacrifices held to honor great men and women at their funerals were not uncommon in the ancient world. In the Iliad, the Greek hero Achilles sacrifices a dozen captured Trojans at the funeral of his lover Patroclus, for example. On the Italian peninsula, it was the Campanians, descendants of Greek settlers, who popularized gladiatorial fights about a century before the death of Brutus Para, though these events were not necessarily associated with funerals. According to the Roman author Livy, the Campanians, borrowing from their ancestral homeland, began the tradition to celebrate a military victory over their archenemies, the Samnites. They dressed slaves in captured Samnite armor and forced them to fight to the death. Some scholars have placed the origins of funerary gladiatorial traditions more to the north in Etruria, which was an influence on and a rival and eventual conquest of Rome. But the earliest known depictions of gladiatorial combat associated with funerals comes from paintings in Campanian tombs as early as the 4th century BC. The inclusion of gladiatorial fights at funerals steadily increased in Rome throughout the last centuries BC. And the numbers of gladiators at each minues also grew. In 216 BC, more than 40 gladiators fought to the death at the funeral of the consul Marcus Aemilius Lepidus. Less than four decades later, in 183 BC, the funeral of the statesman Plebeius Licinius included 120 gladiators, and contests lasted 3 days. Like the distribution of meat and wine, these violent spectacles demonstrated the power and the deceased family to the public. The fights were initially staged in the Forum Boranium, Rome's cattle market, and included little in the way of accommodation for the audience. However, as the fights grew in scale and popularity, they were moved to the larger Forum Romanium, where wooden stands could be entered to seat the rapidly growing crowds. The gladiators also changed. At first, they'd been slaves, armed with simple weapons and no armor. They had little to no training and were simply forced to fight as best they could. Some organizers of Funerae Munera began equipping the slaves with armor of the sort worn by Roman soldiers, including chainmail. But the protective gear prolonged the fights, and the goal was, after all, spectacle and human sacrifice, not survival. As a result, the armor was pared down, leaving the gladiators with the iconic combination of greaves, helmets, and shields. There was little protection for the chest, so wounds were more likely to be fatal. The spectacle would be as bloody as possible. By the 1st century BC, the munus had become a political tool, though one which was still linked to funerary rites, at least on paper. Any Roman dignitary who wished to be elected to an important public office would stage lavish funerary games to win the favor of the people, often with the flimsiest of excuses. Julius Caesar, wishing to further his political career in 65 BC, staged a munus for his father, who'd been dead for 20 years, during which 640 gladiators fought wearing armor made of solid silver. 19 years later, Caesar repeated his triumph with another munus, this time for his daughter, who had been dead for nearly a decade. To increase the novelty factor of these games, Caesar included not just combat between enslaved gladiators, but also a spectacular fight between two members of the Roman aristocracy who had unwisely supported Caesar's political opponent, Pompey. Within a year of those games, Caesar had been murdered by members of the Roman Senate and Rome had descended into civil war. During the imperial era, emperors banned munera thrown by private individuals without express permission. This did not, however, mean the end of the gladiatorial combat. Instead, the fights and games became state-run spectacles, meant to honor the emperor and bolster his popularity with plebeians, who remained as hungry as ever for blood, bread, and circuses. That's all the time we have for Uncommon Wonders today. I hope you'll join us next time. I'm Kyla Thomas for the Virginia Voice.